Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. For Appalachia, the 1st of April means anniversaries of tough times, from tornadoes.
I just hope to God next time somebody listens when there's a tornado warning out. I know there will around here.
To coal disasters.
Someone once said, history makes some amends for the shortness of human life. Sadly, history tells our country's worst mining disaster was right here in Monongah, West Virginia.
But now the hope of changing a culture while staying true to our roots.
There's a lot of history here that needs to be celebrated because of the great sacrifices that families before us made.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly, in for Cecilia Mason. It's been almost 3 months since a chemical leak into the Elk River in Charleston, West Virginia, contaminated drinking water for 300,000 customers. Since then, the state passed a new law that requires, among other actions, better monitoring of above-ground storage tanks. Now, federal lawmakers are looking into the need for national regulations. Senator Joe Manchin's Chemical Safety and Drinking Water Protection Act was passed unanimously by the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works this week. The committee's chair, Senator Barbara Boxer of California, called it a proud day for West Virginia and a step in the right direction. Ashton Mara of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
He knows full well what happens when a community is upended because some kind of chemical gets into the drinking water supply, and he went to work.
Chairwoman Boxer addressed Senator Manchin, who is not a member of the Committee on Environment and Public Works, Thursday morning after its members passed the bill onto the full United States Senate with the recommendation it pass. The bill was introduced on January 27th.
It's very unusual that we have a senator come, but I just felt, given the situation, and the people in West Virginia deserve to have their spirits lifted. This was wonderful.
Manchin gave a brief statement about the bill and the importance of the bipartisan support shown by the committee's members.
By the grace of God, it could have been any state. Really could have been.
No question.
It's something that we all took for granted or thought that everything above ground, whether it was hazmat or not, a hazardous material, should have been inspected, especially if it's close to your waterways or close to your filtration plants. That wasn't being done. And every one of the senators here on both sides of the aisle, in your state, same thing could happen. It happened in West Virginia.
The purpose of the 11-page bill is to protect surface water from contamination by chemical storage facilities. It calls for the establishment of a state source water protection program that provides oversight and inspections of chemical storage facilities. The bill sets minimum federal standards that chemical tanks must meet, including construction and leak detection requirements, secondary containment standards, and the development of emergency response plans. Companies must inform the state, the Environmental Protection Agency, and local water systems of the chemicals they store. Facilities in a source water area are required to be inspected every 3 years under the law, and all others every 5 years. The bill also gives the state authority to issue corrective orders and provides any costs the state may incur will be paid by site owners. Senator Rockefeller, who is a co-sponsor of the legislation, said in a release, the bill moves the U.S. toward closing loopholes in the regulatory system and protects taxpayers from footing the bill for any future chemical spills.
That was Ashton Mara with West Virginia Public Radio reporting. It's been 4 years since an explosion ripped through an underground coal mine in southern West Virginia, killing 29 men and mangling everything in its path. Four investigations into the Upper Big Branch disaster pointed to poor conditions in the mine and a culture that put production above safety. So what does it take to change an entire culture?
All right, now here's one by Ricky Skaggs. Daylight or dark, in rain or shine, it don't much matter. It don't much matter about the rain and the sunshine, because you're underground. And most of the time, the air does get thin.
Since the Upper Big Branch explosion that killed his son, Gary Quarles finds some comfort in a few country songs that he can relate to. The songs supply a glimpse into coal culture, one that Judy Jones Peterson is also in tune with. She lost her brother Edward Dean Jones in the blast. Growing up in Wyoming County, she says several of her family members worked in the industry. Although limited, the occasional phone conversations with her brother would usually be a cry for help. Peterson is a physician, and Dean Jones' son has cystic fibrosis. She remembers a father who wanted the very best for his son.
So he was trapped in a situation of having to maintain this job so he could maintain health coverage for his son. And the company and the people he worked with and for knew that about him. And so they knew that through this practice of intimidation that they could force my brother to put himself at risk, and the men underneath him, who he loved and cared for deeply, they were his family.
Testimonies revealed that several of the men were scared to speak up about safety concerns for fear of losing their jobs and benefits. As part of the Running Right program, now owner Alpha Natural Resources offers cards for the miners to fill out with complaints or suggestions. Between 2011 and 2013, more than 1.7 million Running Right cards were turned in. Still, some miners are skeptical of the anonymity. Last year, a miner working at Alpha Mine, Cobra Natural Resources, says the company retaliated after he turned in one of those cards. According to court documents, Russell Ratliff argued that company officials could identify him based on the content of the cards because the information pointed to specific times when the issues occurred. He also argued that the company could recognize his handwriting since they had it on file from safety checks and even human resources paperwork. The company said Ratliff had a reputation as being a troublemaker, and deciphering his writing among the cards was just not possible. However, the administrative law judge ruled in Ratliff's favor. In February, the U.S. Attorney's Office closed the Non-Prosecution Agreement, or NPA, with Alpha. That agreement included building a state-of-the-art Running Right Leadership Academy that's already seen more than 10,000 Alpha employees pass through its doors for instruction. A sign reads, "Come as you are," as you enter the building.
Part of that, and you'll see with some of our folks here today, is they come with their work boots on, they come with their stripes or the coveralls, whatever they feel comfortable in.
Gary Frampton, a former Massey employee, is the director of administration at the academy.
Part of our Running Right culture and that process about not just checking the books, but it's going about the, we should be able to take, and if you see Gary doing something wrong, then what we enable and empower our people to do is to have a one-on-one conversation about that process. And if you especially focusing upon the unsafe behaviors. So if you see me doing something like that, you should call me out. We should have a discussion about it. And that's part of how to go about conducting a good safety observation.
The facility is equipped with 8 classrooms named after coal seams, but mostly hands-on type training such as a mine simulator, mobile mine rescue unit, and virtual reality theater.
And we've been too guilty in this industry over my 41 years now of butts in the seat approach, reading plans, going through PowerPoints, death by PowerPoint, you know. First aid was, you know, here's direct pressure, here's elevation, and here's where you put a tourniquet on. And what we're able to do here at the Academy and what Alpha's enabled us to do is it's the hands-on approach. It's butts out of the seat, boots on the ground, going inside the simulated mine lab. We're simulating a 200-pound mannequin crushed between a wall, a mine wall, and a shuttle car. That's your first aid project.
Joe Kennedy is the senior simulator instructor at the Running Right Academy.
We bring guys in that might need some brush up on continuous miner, rock truck, shuttle car, roof boater, and just focus on their needs. And that's what makes this program so special is it's so diverse. We're only limited by our imagination, really. I mean, we can, if it's machine failures, if it's machine health, if it's productivity issues, if it's safety issues.
Frampton says supervisors determine if a miner needs to attend the academy.
several of the instances we've had, it's been a thought that this supervisor, production supervisor at the operation, called and asked, "Hey, I've got this. I have an issue with this guy. Can you fix that? Can you help me to fix that?" So we tailor the program to fix the individual needs and mindset needs also.
Inside the simulator, a miner with 20 years of mining experience is holding the control panels to a virtual continuous mining machine, head down. He said he's been operating the miner for only a few years. Massey's investigation pointed to a sudden inundation of gas and MSHA for approving a poor ventilation system. The results seem to magnify the attitude that the regulatory agency charged to help keep the mine safe is the enemy. Still, an internal investigation found that the agency had several shortcomings. MSHA has touted that 100 things have changed for the agency since UBB. Judy Jones Peterson believes that the culture will change when the workers, operators, and regulators work together.
So when you have that environment where there's no respect among these three groups working together, then there's no way that UBB isn't going to happen again. It has to change.
Frampton also points out that Alpha has went 15 months without a fatality. He worked for MSHA for 2.5 years.
The agency is the agency. They're the government. And, what are you going to do with them, right? They're there to police things. It appears a lot of times it's more today, so in reality, it's more punitive than regulatory side of it and what have you like that. But we've got some very good relationships with the agency. Do we agree with everything that we have to put in plans? I'd be lying if I sat here and told you that, okay? But so what do we do? You can butt heads every day, or you can take and look at it. How do I go about mining and that whole process? So
Peterson says the facility and the Running Right program are a start. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Sadly, Upper Big Branch was just one of hundreds of explosions and coal mine disasters that have occurred throughout American history. All told, 104,819 Americans and counting have died in coal mine accidents since 1900. And in the early part of the century, thousands of American miners died on the job every year. The deadliest accident of them all happened in Monongah, West Virginia, in 1907. And as we remember Upper Big Branch today, we bring you a radio adaptation of a film shot by Apple Shop's Herb Heath Smith at a ceremony remembering Monongah at its 100th anniversary in 2007. WMMT's Parker Hobson has this story.
Woods Sheikh Basiman, Joseph Bagala, Giuseppe Belcastro, Serafino Belcastro, Angelo Berardo, Celestino Berardo, Felice Berardo, Giacinto Berardo, Michael Bilio, Antonio.
On December 6th, 2007, in 14-degree weather, state officials, foreign dignitaries, local residents, and school children all came together in the small town of Monongah in Marion County, West Virginia. They had gathered for a ceremony and memorial service to commemorate the worst coal mine disaster in U.S. history on its 100th anniversary. Apple Shop filmmaker Herbie Smith was there to document the day, and he collected all the audio you'll hear in this piece. Among those present at the ceremony was then West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin.
Someone once said, "History makes some amends for the shortness of human life." Sadly, history tells our country's worst mining disaster was right here in Monongah, West Virginia. 100 years ago, hundreds of lives were lost. The official count was 362. It was probably many, many more. We have a responsibility to tell their story.
At 10:20 a.m. on December 6, 1907, an explosion tore through the Mananga No. 6 and No. 8 coal mines, which were both operated by the Fairmont Coal Company and connected by tunnels underground. It was never definitively discovered what caused the explosion. It could have been excessive methane or coal dust, or some combination of both, that was ignited by a spark. Within minutes of the explosion, much of the mine roof had collapsed, and hundreds were dead. Rescue efforts went on for days, but were hindered by a lack of proper breathing equipment to handle the toxic air in the collapsed mine. Only 5 men made it out alive, and coffins lined the streets of Mananga for remains to be identified by loved ones. It's not known exactly how many people were killed, but researchers think it could have been as many as 550. Among them were children, some perhaps as young as 8, and many of the miners were immigrants from countries like Poland, Ireland, Italy, Slovakia, and Hungary. At the 100th anniversary ceremony, Bishop Michael Bransfield dedicated a bell in Mananga's town square that was donated by the Italian region of Molise in memory of those Italians who were killed.
Today we are privileged to bless this bell, which has been cast to serve as a work of art, as a summons to the people of Mananga, and as a commemoration of the tragic event of 1907. Let us pray that God will watch over the people of this community, that whenever they hear the peal of this bell, they will remember that they are one family coming together to show their unity and their faith.
We're here to pay that respect to all those people that they lost their life in 1907 in a disaster mine.
Many Italians also made the trip to Mananga to attend the ceremony.
220 miners were from Italy.
220?
Yeah.
Some have was from Abruzzo, some from Calabria.
Calabria,
some
Molise.
From Veneto. Molise? From all over from Italy, all over Italy.
So they thought it was a great opportunity to come over, which it was, but, you know, the disaster they have all the time. I guess at that time, the safety was not as important for the coal industry as it is today.
Remember, this is 1907. That year, there were 3,250 died in the mines.
Historian and mine safety advocate David McAteer has written a book on Mananga, and he said the disaster helped spur the first federal legislation to deal with mine safety, the Organic Act of 1910. This law established the Bureau of Mines, a government agency that would conduct training programs and that would investigate explosions and other mine accidents. McAteer said this was a first for its time.
This mine disaster becomes this big story. Mm-hmm. New York Times is here, all the major papers. Of course, Congress has never allowed the federal government to be involved in any regulation of the workplace until that point. And there's an effort to try to say, well, the federal government ought to have a role in this. These corporations are huge. And they were saying, oh, no, the states are the only ones that can regulate us, which was just a front to keep the industry from being regulated.
McAteer said that mine safety has come a long way since 1907.
Oh, we've come light years away. We're not killing 1,000 people a month. We're years and years and years ahead now. It took us a long time. We killed about 150,000 people to get there, which is a sad commentary on the regulated industry. And we still have significant problems.
The pace of accidents has slowed down, but they keep happening. 162 American coal miners have been killed on the job just in the 6.5 years since this ceremony, and April 5th marks the 4th anniversary of the Upper Big Branch disaster, another explosion at another West Virginia mine, which killed 29 coal miners at once in 2010. At the Mananga ceremony in 2007, then-Governor and now-Senator Joe Manchin had this to say.
I've said this and I will continue to say it. The mining men and women who've suffered, who've died, make a better life for themselves and their families, did not die in vain. We've made historic changes. Mining is safer and getting better, and we will continue, and we will not stop Our goal is to make sure there's no accident whatsoever in any of our mines, no more tragedies.
In the wake of Upper Big Branch, West Virginia passed what Governor Earl Ray Tomlin called, quote, a comprehensive mine safety bill, end quote, in 2012, a centerpiece of which was a decrease in how much methane would be allowed in mines before operations and machines had to shut down. But the coal industry fought this, and a state board dragged its feet and never actually finalized the new methane rule. So just last month, the state tried again, passing a weaker version of the new methane standard. West Virginia has also stalled on adopting rules that would require heavy equipment underground to automatically shut down if miners were detected nearby, which could also save lives. It's now been 4 years since Upper Big Branch, but a key component of the bill passed in its aftermath was stalled, then weakened, and has still not taken effect. And little change seems to have come to West Virginia's coal mines in the wake of the tragedy.
I cannot explain human nature to you. Why it takes a tragedy such as this proportion for us to bring change about. But the worst tragedy would be if we didn't bring any change about after a horrible accident such as that.
For WMMT and with Herbie Smith, I'm Parker Hobson.
This was a radio adaptation of a short film produced by Apple Shop filmmaker Herb P. Smith on the 100th anniversary of the Monongah disaster. For more on Apple Shop films, check out appleshop.org. The first days of April mean yet another tragic day for residents of West Virginia and also Kentucky and Ohio. April 3, 1974, 148 tornadoes swept through the South and Midwest, leaving a path of destruction that spanned 2,600 miles. More than 300 people were killed, 31 of them in Brandenburg, Kentucky. The National Civil Defense Preparedness Agency produced a television documentary about the disaster. It was narrated by Fred Collins and includes actual sounds from that day. 40 years later, here are some excerpts.
Tornadoes are hitting Tennessee, Georgia, Ohio, 2 in Illinois, 2 more in Indiana. Another sighted near Hardinsburg, Kentucky, heading toward Brandenburg, a sleepy little river town 25 miles southwest of Louisville. At the radio station, just west of town, announcer Bill Byrne receives a telephone call telling of its coming.
Tornado!
The only warning, a last-second shout, and in 30 seconds, 31 people will die. In Louisville, upriver, an alarm sounds in the newsroom at WHAS, the local emergency broadcast station.
The severe thunderstorm warning has been changed to a tornado warning for Metro Louisville, Jefferson County, including Meade,
Fire Department,
Bullitt Counties, and the southern Indiana counties.
We have a tornado reported on the ground in the Brandenburg vicinity.
And it's headed toward Louisville. But we think the
siren should be activated at the present time.
Okay, hit the yellow alert.
Can you see at this point?
Well, it's a spectacular sight. The low clouds, very black low clouds.
We've found parts of all the bodies, but we've got to go back and hunt for some more.
It was just a big roar. And I don't know, it was just terrible.
It just sounded like a big train whistle, and we were right underneath the front of it. I've never seen anything like it, and I don't want to again.
What can you do? We've lost everything that we had.
April 3rd, 1974, the day of the killer tornadoes. They killed 307 people in 11 states. In Brandenburg, with no sirens, no weather wire, 31 dead. In Xenia, 33, and Hamilton County around Cincinnati lost only 4 lives, Louisville 3, Huntsville none at all. And the people who lived through it will never forget.
I just hope to God next time somebody listens when there's a tornado warning out. I know there will around here.
Those are sounds from the Day of the Killer Tornadoes, produced by the National Civil Defense Preparedness Agency. The entire half-hour program can be viewed on YouTube. Okay, let's talk wind power. It's been booming in the last 10 years thanks to climate-conscious subsidies for clean energy. But Congress recently cut off one key tax break for wind. In January, a company that makes windmill blades announced plans to shut down a plant in Pennsylvania. As part of the Allegheny Front's Climate Chronicles, Reed Frazier looks at how Washington's chance on clean energy is impacting Pennsylvania's wind belt.
Bradley Malinick started working at Gamesa's windmill blade manufacturing plant in Ebensburg, Pennsylvania in 2006, before the plant was even finished.
I was offered a job before I left the interview, and I started my first day on January 30th, 2006.
Almost 8 years to the day that he started, he was called into a conference room for a 7 a.m. meeting. It was supposed to be a teleconference with top managers from the company, but last minute came word. Those managers had come to town.
And they walked through the doors about 10 after 7 and introduced themselves and said, well, let's just get right down to business.
And that business was the plant would be closing down and the 60 or so workers there would be out of a job.
Felt numb, a little overwhelmed, never had to sit in a meeting like that before. Reality sat in a little bit right then.
Gamesa is a Spanish company that makes windmills. It came to Ebensburg with help from millions of dollars in tax breaks from the state of Pennsylvania. The Ebensburg plant built industrial-scale wind turbine blades, more than 100 feet long. Some of those blades ended up on big wind farms nearby, in the hilly terrain of the southern Alleghenies. Many of these projects benefited from something called the Wind Production Tax Credit. It was started in 1992, and it gave wind farms a tax credit for the electricity they produced. It promoted wind because it's a clean source of energy. Windmills give off no greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide. Scientists say these gases are driving climate change. Liz Salerno is with the American Wind Energy Association. She says wind power installed with help from the tax credit means less carbon dioxide is emitted from burning coal and natural gas.
The fleet that operates right now, the wind energy fleet of turbines that is currently producing power today, they avoid about 100 million tons of CO2 annually.
That's like taking 17 million cars off the road. But the fact that this wind energy tax credit expired every few years made it vulnerable in Congress, especially when it wanted to cut the federal budget.
It is an easy target.
Constantine Samaras studies energy policy at Carnegie Mellon University.
You can think of it as a kind of a billion-dollar tax refund that the government doesn't have to pay if the credit expires.
And Congress has let it expire several times, each time resulting in a steep drop in wind farm construction. The last time was in December. A few weeks later, Gamesa officials gave workers at the Ebensburg plant the pink slip. Among those losing his job is Ed Burnett. He started working at Gamesa in 2007, and for the last few years has been unit president for the United Steelworkers, which represents workers at the plant. He worked as a finisher at Gamesa.
We buttoned everything up. We've put the loose ends together, and if there was anything, if there was any kind of defects, we fixed them as it went.
He'd seen the Ebensburg workforce decline from a high of around 250 just a few years ago to about 60 in January. At the local steelworkers' office, Ed Burnett said the jobs at Gamesa didn't have to go.
We felt betrayed because we'd done everything that we humanly possibly could have thought of to keep that plant up and keep it running.
The union is upset because Gamesa is outsourcing some of the work that had been done in Ebensburg to a turbine manufacturer in Juarez, Mexico, just south of El Paso, Texas. Joe Klein worked in coal mines before he came to work at Gamesa. Now, at the age of 60, he's not sure what he'll do.
We lost good jobs. Jobs we were promised. This plant was to be there for years and years and years. These young people came there told that they could retire from that company, and it was taken from them. How do you face people like that on the floor?
Gamesa officials did not agree to a taped interview, but in an email, the company said most of its customers are now in the Southwest, not the Mid-Atlantic. California and Texas are the two biggest wind producers in the country. The company said it would need to make the changes to stay competitive without the federal tax credit. The plant closing hurts the local economy in Cambria County, which has steadily lost population for the past 70 years. But to Doug Langenfelder, a Cambria County commissioner, it comes as no surprise.
It shouldn't surprise people that when those subsidies go away, the company has to remodel itself, take a good hard look at what it's doing.
Langenfelder is a fiscal conservative, and he's generally against tax subsidies for any type of business. But he admits he saw that the wind tax credit was helping people in his own county.
That production tax credit meant jobs here in Cambria County. And yes, I would have liked to have seen that extended.
On the other hand, he says the tax credit already accomplished what it was supposed to, kickstart the wind industry. Windmills dot the ridges around this old coal mining county. And nationally, wind power has increased tenfold in 10 years. Jim Spencer is CEO of EverPower, a wind company based in Pittsburgh that owns some of those wind farms. His company has benefited from the production tax credit, but he says the PTC, as it's called, may have run its course.
You need a financial incentive when an industry is immature in order for the industry to get legs. And so I think that the PTC has served its purpose.
Spencer thinks that life without the tax credit may actually help the wind industry in the long term.
I think if we are confronted with the realities of making renewable energy work and we don't have what's sometimes been referred to as a crutch, assuming that we're really committed to renewables, then we'll have to find a way which advances renewables in the state and creates a market for it.
He says a far better way to encourage wind would be to make a national renewable energy mandate or to put a price on carbon emissions. But we don't have any of these policies in the U.S. right now. And Samaras of Carnegie Mellon says for better or worse, the tax credit has doubled as a de facto climate policy in the U.S. So those deciding whether or not to extend it should address one simple question.
What is the cost of reducing greenhouse gases per dollar? And is this the most effective way?
Meanwhile, in Ebensburg, the last day for workers at Gamesa is March 31st. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Lovers of real local maple syrup on your pancakes? You're lucky to live in a golden age. That's because eventually rising temperatures could tap out the northeastern maple industry. Federal climate models have predicted the region will lose most of its maple by next century. Right now, producers don't seem worried. Maple syrup prices are high, and with technology, the sap's flowing just fine. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant heads into the sugar bush.
Jason Blotcher's livelihood each year largely depends on the weather in February and March. He's the third generation in his family to run Milroy Maple Farms in Somerset County on Pennsylvania's southern border, just a few miles from Maryland.
You can't outguess Mother Nature, and she controls everything in this business.
It takes warm days and cold nights to get sap flowing through a sugar maple. They start drilling tap holes in the trees when daytime temperatures get in the 40s and nights are still below freezing. When Blotcher was a kid, they would tap in late February and early March, but he says that's changed in the past 10 years. Now they usually tap earlier, as much as a month earlier, and the timing is more erratic. Like most producers, Blotcher remembers the winter of 2012 when there was a thick layer of snow in his maple forest. And then, right as syruping was starting, temperatures shot up into the 80s. It was the warmest March on record.
So we went from fighting our way through 3 or 4 feet of snow in anticipation of a very good season because of that heavy snowpack to one of our poorest seasons we have on record because we had such a drastic change in the weather from cold, deep snow to warm in that you know, in a matter of 2 weeks to 3 weeks, it ruined our season.
Milroy Farms wasn't alone. U.S. syrup production was down as much as 40% in 2012. Erratic years like that aren't a surprise to Dave Cleaves. He's the climate change advisor at the U.S. Forest Service, which means he's often the bearer of bad news.
God, in this job I'm in, and people like this, they hate to see me coming, you know. They run like hell.
About 15 years ago, the Forest Service published what's called the Climate Change Tree Atlas, and what it found didn't look good for sugar maples in the Northeast.
We will see it gradually disappear or become less prominent.
Cleve says southern Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Maryland are on the southern edge of large-scale maple syrup production. He says as the climate changes, they're the first places that will have troubles with maple trees.
Because there are other more aggressive and adapted southern species that are always there, ready to take off and regenerate.
Milroy Farms owner Jason Blotcher says his maple grove grows along Mount Davis, the highest point in Pennsylvania, which gives trees the colder temperatures they like. So he doesn't get too worked up about climate change.
Oh, you hear about that all the time, you know, and the global warming. But I think that sugar maple is a very hardy tree and very adaptable. So I think under slight changes and so forth, it'll adapt.
And some of the top maple syrup researchers in Vermont and New York agree with him. Temperatures in the Northeast already have risen an average of 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970. And they say maple syrup production is going gangbusters. Blotcher is like most producers these days. He uses vacuum tubing to pull sap from the maple trees. This, coupled with other technologies, allows him to double production in half the time it took his parents. Michael Farrell is a maple syrup expert at Cornell University, and he runs a sugar bush in northern New York. In his book, The Sugarmaker's Companion, he says newer forest models, which take factors other than climate into account, show that things don't look as bad as the Forest Service predictions. Farrell says his own PhD research looking at maple trees in the forest mix backs that up.
We're not getting replaced by oaks and hickories up here in the Northeast. It's very unlikely that that's going to happen. And, you know, the foresters down in the mid-Atlantic, Midwest, where there's a lot of oak and hickory, you know, they're concerned that they're not getting the regeneration of oak and hickory. And they consider, a lot of them consider sugar and red maple invasive species down there.
But that's not what the Forest Service is seeing in the long term, 85 years from now, in the time frame of a tree's life. Dave Cleaves says maple producers and researchers may be experiencing good times now. Trees aren't falling over and dying. But Forest Service studies that look at changes in the woodlands every few years don't find many maple saplings in the Northeast.
When they actually get down on the ground and count the seedlings by species, then they get an idea of, well, what is this future forest likely to look like? Because we're looking at the babies here.
Cornell researcher Michael Farrell says the biggest danger to young sugar maples is deer, which can eat the saplings. And syrup producers like Jason Blotcher are more concerned about invasive insects like the Asian longhorn beetle than warming temperatures. But the Forest Service's Dave Cleaves says problems like these are intertwined with climate change.
It's not just the changing climate itself that impacts. It works through these stressors that are already there. Say it's moisture stress on the forest if it gets too dry, or if it gets wetter and moister and that's more conducive to insect and disease proliferation, then it's working through insect and disease.
At Milroy Farms, Jason Blotcher says there's nothing he can do about global warming, so he doesn't worry about it. But some forest researchers go so far as to call the maple tree a poster child for climate change in the Northeast because they say it's a resilient tree that might not make it unless efforts to cut greenhouse gases take root. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
A conference to celebrate Appalachia kicked off this week at Wheeling Jesuit University in northern West Virginia. It's a month-long celebration of all things Appalachia. Glennis Board of West Virginia Public Radio has more about the series of lectures and events.
An open letter addressed by a bishop to Catholic clergy, laity, and the general public in 1975 was called, "This Land is Home to Me." It was the impetus for what's become the Appalachian Institute at Wheeling Jesuit University, a place for research, service, and advocacy for and with the people of Appalachia. From that place, through the initiative of a VISTA volunteer turned director of the Institute, Celebrate Appalachia has grown. Beth Collins was that volunteer. She says what started as a single night of celebrating Appalachian culture with food and revelry has turned into a month full of events that shines a spotlight on everything from corncob pipes and bluegrass music to mountaintop removal coal mining techniques. This year, events began with some traditional Catholic ceremonial prayer.
It was Stations of the Cross around rural Appalachian communities. And so about 25 people came and focused on like Lent and focused on those challenges of rural life and praying intentionally for the communities that we live in and also that we're surrounded by here in Appalachia.
Next on the agenda, the organization called Keepers of the Mountain will be on campus to discuss the complexities of mountaintop removal mining. Tom Briding, also with the Appalachian Institute, says Celebrate Appalachia is an opportunity to recognize industry's past and present.
There's a lot of history here that needs to be celebrated because of the great sacrifices that families before us made. But there are a lot of current issues, too, where we want to raise awareness so that the same mistakes aren't being made that were made 100 years ago when the coal industry was really taking root in the state.
Also, much in that vein, the following week, Peabody Award-winning journalist Elaine McMillian will present her interactive documentary, Hollow, which explores the history of Southern West Virginia. She will also be there collecting stories, so the Institute is hoping folks will come and share their ideas of what home is.
People are invited to come and tell their idea of what home means to them for like 5 or 10 minutes, and then that will be put into a larger documentary series. She's going all around West Virginia and collecting these stories.
Collins says the following week, around Earth Day, events will surround gardening and sustainability themes. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The first week in April is also Congress Week, a time when the Association of Centers for the Study of Congress hopes to make the public more aware of the role Congress plays in our government. It was April 1789 when the House and Senate achieved their first quorums and launched the government of the United States. On this 225th anniversary, Ray Smock, the director of the Robert C. Byrd Center for Legislative Studies at Shepherd University, ponders the fact that this branch of government is not as heralded as the others.
I have a confession to make. I love the United States Congress. I don't recall hearing that from anyone else lately, although I do know there are others who could say the same thing. If you can trust the latest poll, only 6% approve of the current Congress. I doubt that most in that group would go so far as to profess love of the institution. My expression of love and respect for this vital American institution is not based on its current state of dilapidation and dysfunction. It is based on its survival and its level of success over 225 years in finding ways to make representative democracy work. It has, in greater or lesser degrees at different times in our history, fulfilled its responsibilities under Article I of the United States Constitution. It was Congress that wrote the Bill of Rights and created the cabinet offices used by presidents since George Washington. Every good law and every bad law has come from Congress. Every national policy is filtered through Congress. Every dime spent and every tax dollar levied in the past 225 years, and every debt incurred and every debt paid has come from the action of Congress. The United States is a product of a remarkable and complex set of partnerships of Congress with the people, with the presidency, and with American business, tempered from time to time by the Supreme Court. We have a hard time putting a personal face on Congress in the same way that we can the presidency or the Supreme Court. Only 43 individuals have been president, and we measure our political history by their administrations. Only 17 individuals have been Chief Justice in the past 225 years. and only 112 individuals have served in the entire history of the Supreme Court. The court's history, too, is often measured by the name of the Chief Justice. But in the People's Branch, more than 11,200 people have served in the House and 1,950 in the Senate, with about 600 or so serving in both the House and the Senate. What face do we put on Congress? Instead, Congress gets other labels, like the famous 80th Congress in 1947-48, which President Harry Truman called the Do-Nothing Congress, even though that Congress passed considerable, significant, far-reaching legislation. Over the years, thousands upon thousands of books have been written about the United States history from the perspective of the presidency. We have a system of presidential libraries and museums to the modern presidents since Herbert Hoover, which are paid for and maintained with ample private and taxpayer dollars. Yet nothing comparable exists for Congress. True, there is the magnificent Capitol Visitor Center, but this is not a research facility. Across the street from the Capitol is the Great Library of Congress, but it is not the depository of the official records of Congress. The voluminous committee records of Congress, almost as extensive as those in all the presidential libraries, are housed at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., but are owned and controlled by Congress. Maybe we could appreciate Congress more and understand it better if we knew more about it. But not just the stuff of daily headlines and tweets, not through the distorted lens of mind-numbing partisanship, but a good hard look at the remarkable achievements, the colossal failures, the great wisdom, and the utter stupidity that define this great experiment in government. The history of Congress after 225 years is the greatest story never told. We don't know Congress as well as we should because we have never studied it as systematically as we have the presidency or the federal court system. The story of Congress is filled with charlatans and frauds, and also with noble men and women who have defended the Constitution, understood the importance of the legislative branch as the fulcrum of our government, and devoted themselves to making government work on behalf of the American people. I wish the United States Congress a happy 225th birthday. I hope this marvelous institution is still functioning 100 years hence and 200 years hence, or for as long as the people of the United States value freedom and democratic government.
Ray Smock is the director of the Robert C. Byrd Center for Legislative Studies at Shepherd University. He served as historian of the U.S. House of Representatives from 1983 until 1995. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisonburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.